The most recent gray wolf population estimate in Wisconsin shows a healthy comeback. We're looking at the future of the gray wolf and habitats here in Wisconsin and nationwide on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The monitoring report from the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, shows a notable increase in the wolf count after three stable years of numbers. And wolf packs are steadily climbing as well. Meanwhile, the Trump administration wants to take gray wolves off of the endangered and threatened species list. The Associated Press reported a timeline by the end of the year. What do you think about federal efforts to lift protections? Is it too soon? We're at 800-642-1234. Peter David is a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here, and miigwech, or thank you for the opportunity.
Well, can you put some numbers on Wisconsin's gray wolf population? What are you seeing?
Well, I would say the numbers that I'm putting out are not really my own, but coming out of that DNR report, but that population has grown. We were a bit surprised, as you indicated. The most recent count, and Wisconsin conducts a minimum count. This is the way they've operated in the past. It's really an attempt to try to census every animal on the landscape as to the degree possible. And that minimum population count came in at about 1,035 animals, which is about 100 more than we were at a year ago. And that was a little bit of an uptake and a little bit of a surprise. But it's not a total shock. There's been some population modeling done that suggests that the carrying capacity in Wisconsin might be even a bit higher, up around 1,250 animals. So it'll be very interesting to see what this population does, I guess, going forward.
Yeah, and by comparison, in the early 2000s, there were under 500 gray wolves in the state, and in the 90s, it was under 100?
Well, it's good to place, I think, today's number in sort of the historical context. And if you go way back in time to sort of pre-European contact, the best estimates that there were maybe 3,000 to 5,000 wolves in the state. But this was a species, that Europeans didn't value. They had a lot of negative connotations culturally with them. And there was tremendous effort to drive that population down. And Wisconsin had a bounty on wolves, from 1865 all the way to 1957. And by the time that bounty was finally lifted, the population was nearly gone. And by about 1960, Wisconsin was wolfless. And so it was sort of amazing that we have this population that we do today that came back from a remnant population that was able to survive in Minnesota. That population expanded under the protection of the Endangered Species Act and eventually, created this opportunity for wolves to recover both in Wisconsin and in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Do you connect their rebound, their recovery from from almost total devastation to being on the Endangered Species Act?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that was a critical part of letting wolves stay on the landscape. One of the biggest causes of mortality in wolves are humans. And so protecting them from humans really allowed that population to recover.
We're talking with Peter David, a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. We're looking at the future of gray wolves as federal protections are set to be rolled back in most of the lower 48 states. Are you a hunter or a farmer? Do you think lethal control should be allowed for gray wolves? Do you think it's time to take gray wolves off of the endangered species list? Or do you think they need more time to recover across the country? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Peter, why going back, decades, hundreds of years, did Europeans not want this top predator, these wolves around? Why was there this effort to wipe them out?
Well, I think there's two parts to that, at least. Some of it is that wolves do occasionally cause people problems, and especially when you have very agriculture-based livestock raising cultures, then wolves are oftentimes sort of viewed as a problem, a threat to your livestock and to your occupation. I think some of it goes, all the way back to religious training, the worldview that people bring forward You know, I was raised myself. I'm not a tribal member. I've worked for the tribes for over three decades. But, you know, my own family's upbringing and religious background was that humans were here to have dominion over other parts of the world. And so part of that was to take control of things like wolves and control them and put them in their place, if you will. That really contrasts completely with the Ojibwe worldview.
Can you explain a little bit more about the indigenous approach to gray wolves and their management?
Well, so I would talk from an Ojibwe perspective.
Anyway. Yeah.
I know there's many different indigenous approaches or perspectives towards wolves, but the tribes that I work for, Mayingan, or the wolf, plays a really critical cultural role, and it goes all the way back to the tribe's creation story. And sort of similar to the Bible, there is a sequence in that creation story. All the other parts of creation, the earth, the landscape, the plants, the animals, were all placed first before the original man was brought down. And it had to be that way because that original man was dependent upon all those other orders of creation. But in the Ojibwe telling, this veers very differently from the Bible now because part of that thing of being placed last was a recognition that you're actually not the most important, but the least important being here. And you have to be sort of humble and accepting of that role. But that story goes on to tell that original man eventually actually came to be lonely of spirit and talked to the Creator about that. And the Creator responded, interestingly, by providing a wolf for him to walk and talk and play with. And the two of them were given the task of visiting all the earth places together. And they grew very close. They became like brothers in this. And I have to say, this is a very, very abbreviated telling of this as it's been shared with me. But they must have been surprised when they went back to the Creator, who then indicated that they actually had to separate and go their own ways. But their fates were going to be forever intertwined. And what would happen to one would happen to the other. And the Ojibwe have embraced that and believe it is their responsibility to really think about the wolf's best interest because really they're thinking about their own survival and their own best interests at the same time.
Have the Ojibwe had a voice in how we treat gray wolves today?
They've had a limited voice, but it's been quite limited. It's sort of an interesting artifact, but you know, the Voight litigation, the case that reestablished the tribe's treaty reserved rights here in Wisconsin, really doesn't address wolves. At the time of that litigation, there were only a handful of wolves in the state, and they were completely under federal control. And as a result, there wasn't a whole lot that the state could stipulate to. And so, you know, there's sort of extensive stipulations when it comes to things like deer and walleye. But wolves are really not talked about, and I think that's a problem today as this population has grown, and it's particularly an issue should wolves be delisted and be under state and tribal control again.
We're talking with Peter David, a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. We're discussing the future of gray wolves and what it would mean to remove them from the endangered species list. Have you seen wolves in your part of the state? What do you observe about their habitat, their movements? Should they be protected? Join in with your experiences, your questions about gray wolves. It's 800-642-1234 to join in. We'll be back in a minute with Peter David right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the population growth of gray wolves in Wisconsin and efforts at the federal level to remove wolves from the endangered species list. Last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put forth a proposal to delist gray wolves. They have been protected under the Endangered Species Act since 1978. What do you think of the recovery story of gray wolves? What is the next chapter? What questions do you have about wolf packs in Wisconsin versus Minnesota? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have wildlife biologist Peter David with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission as our guide. So, Peter, the Wisconsin DNR changed its methodology for counting wolves last year. Can you explain the approach or the revision?
Well, they'll really be embracing this change next year.
Okay.
But as I mentioned, up to this point in time, they really attempted to census the entire wolf population. Now, you guys know that there's a small number of wolves that are missed. You can't find everyone. But it was a very intensive survey, and it was really sort of the gold standard, I thought, of counting wolves. But one can imagine that as the population grew from, you know, 50 to 100 to 500 and out to about 1,000, that's an intensive labor, intensive process. And so they're trying to find a way that does a reasonable job of estimating wolf numbers without such an intense involvement. And so over the last 3 years, they've been developing what's called a patch occupancy model, where they sort of divide the range of the wolf into blocks and then estimate what is the likelihood of each of those blocks being occupied by wolves, and then applying some things like average home range size and average pack size to come up with an estimated population. And that apparently is the methodology they'll be going forward with.
Are wolf numbers counted differently in state to state? Does methodology differ around the country?
It tends to vary a little bit everywhere you go. And so if you look just here at the Midwest, you know, each of the three states do somewhat of a different approach to counting wolves. And, you know, people can imagine that it's hard to count wolves, and there's always criticism, actually, of those techniques. But I just thought Wisconsin's approach really was the best, although admitted it was expensive. But all three states actually seem to be doing a reasonably good job, and I think one of the indications of that is that the numbers that are generated make sense relative to each other. So, for example, we know that Minnesota's got quite a bit more habitat than Wisconsin does, and their population has sort of plateaued out in recent years at around 2,700 animals. In the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, their numbers have plateaued out about 700 using the technique that they use. And so it sort of makes relative sense, I guess I would say, that Wisconsin might end up in this ballpark of around 1,000, perhaps as high as 1,200 wolves.
Peter, what does delisting mean for the gray wolf? What does that really mean? What are the consequences?
Well, this is such a huge issue. And to recap a little bit, wolves have been taken off a couple of times here in the Midwest off of the endangered species list. Each one of the times that has happened, legal challenges have put them back on. But most recently, last year, Fish and Wildlife Service proposed again to delist wolves. And there was a tremendous public response to that. They originally extended their 60-day comment period to 120 days. And I think that by the time it was all over, I believe that this was the most publicly commented on rule that the Federal Register had ever announced.
Mm. You testified in Brainerd last year.
Oh, I did, yes. And there's a lot into this. It's one thing that's really hard about this is that it's hard for us not to think about this on a very local issue. And I think a lot of arguments can be made that in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, the UP, wolves have recovered. The Fish and Wildlife Service didn't propose delisting just that area. They, in fact, proposed delisting gray wolves essentially everywhere across the historic range in the country where they're not already delisted, including many areas that were historically wolf habitat, currently have wolf habitat, but where recovery hasn't happened. So really on the basis of the recovery of this population in the Midwest, you know, delisting was going to occur literally from Maine to California and everywhere in between. And so there's a lot of those places where recovery hasn't taken place, and that's one of the great objections, I think, to the proposal that Fish and Wildlife put out there.
Let me just reintroduce you here for a moment. Peter David is a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. We're talking about gray wolves and their numbers as federal protections are set to be lifted in most of the lower 48. You can join in. Do you think it's time to take gray wolves off the endangered species list, or do they need time to recover across the country? What do you want to know about their population? It's 800-642-1234. Peter, would delisting mean more access to hunting or controlling, culling the gray wolf population?
So, yes. So delisting essentially means regulation or control of wolves goes from the Fish and Wildlife Service to the state and to the tribes. And so that opens up an opportunity for different types of harvest taking place. And in fact, I think in some ways it's unfortunate, but in Wisconsin, the legislature back in 2012 actually decided that it was wise to pass a law that indicated that if wolves were not on the federal endangered species list, in fact, that Wisconsin was required to have a wolf hunting season, a recreational harvesting. That's different. That's sort of much more prescriptive than we've seen in other states. For example, in Minnesota, where the department has the authority and they may have a hunting season, but not required to actually have one. So it's unfortunate that in Wisconsin it ties this delisting issue and the hunting issue right together.
Mm.
And we saw the last time during that delisting, it was from 2012 to 2014, Wisconsin did have three harvest seasons, and there were significant numbers of wolves taken during that period. It also opened up lethal depredation control. That's one thing that's interesting right now. Minnesota wolves are actually listed as threatened, while in Wisconsin they're listed as endangered. Under threatened, there is a possibility for lethal depredation control for livestock situations and that kind of thing. Our member tribes prefer non-lethal control whenever that's possible, but actually have not been opposed to the judicial application of lethal control. But that's not been a tool that's been available in Wisconsin or Michigan. But back in, say, 2013, for example, which was the heavily hit year between depredation control and recreational harvests and other known mortalities, there were over 360 wolves known to have died in Wisconsin that year. And that's really a pretty remarkable figure. It had taken over 30 years for the state population to reach 360. And then that was the number that were of known mortalities just in that year.
And when I looked at that line graph, you could see it right there, that plummet, that something had happened.
Exactly.
I want to ask you about this. Two congressmen in the House, Colin Peterson of Minnesota and Rob Bishop of Utah, they had introduced the American Wild Game and Livestock Protection Act earlier this year. You know, it would delist the gray wolf, as we've been talking about, and give states the ability to make their own rules about hunting and culling of gray wolf populations. What do you think of this legislation?
You know, I think there's a great deal of concern that is inappropriate, that it really serves to undermine the Endangered Species Act. If you're going to apply that here, you're going to cherry pick whatever time that you find the Endangered Species Act doesn't make it easy for you to reach certain other objectives, and soon it'll be gutted and won't have much meaning. You know, wolves are a flashpoint species for some people, but a lot of that goes back to old myths that we know in scientific support really aren't true. And what's really interesting is that the public is understanding that more and more. But the public in general oftentimes isn't very well represented in the realms of natural resource agencies. You know, they listen to their primary constituents and the people who are purchasing licenses and feel like that is where their greatest responsibility lies. But when you survey the public in general, both, and there have been surveys done in both Wisconsin and Minnesota within the last 10 years that indicate broad support from the average person in the state to have healthy and robust wolf populations.
You know, this legislation would also make the issuance of the rule not subject to judicial review. Could there be court battles here?
Well, it does seem like this is a realm that you can't get away from court battles. It's too bad. I think it's inappropriate, but there is it's hard to get off the pendulum here in some ways, to swing from complete protection under the Endangered Species Act to sort of wide open harvest in some situations when they come off is a problem. There's a lot of people who are suggesting that really, especially if you look at wolves from a national level, like the Endangered Species Act does, that maybe they should be listed threatened nationally, which would give some additional opportunities. The other example I give is that, the tribes have been opposed to delisting for cultural reasons and because they think the sort of protections that the Endangered Species Act provides are appropriate, regardless. And it's really similar to eagles.
Let's pause there with the comparison to bald eagles. We're talking about the gray wolf, which once roamed freely in the U.S., its population doing well in Wisconsin. We're learning about what the future holds with Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission biologist Peter David as our guide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the future of gray wolves as efforts are underway at the federal level to lift protections. We're looking at all aspects of this here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, gray wolves used to roam freely throughout much of the U.S. By the mid-1900s, they were rooted out of most of the lower 48 states. What do you want to know about their territory, their packs, their existence in Wisconsin and other states? Are you a hunter or a farmer? Do you think lethal control should be allowed for gray wolves? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Peter David is a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and he's our guide. Peter, where we left off, we're looking to compare bald eagle protections that may inform how we approach gray wolves. What do you see there?
Well, yeah, I was discussing the sort of rapid swing we see sometimes in management when wolves come off the endangered species list. And I think that was really reiterated to me just a few days ago when the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board met and got an update on wolf status in the state. And that conversation switched really quickly to, how soon could we begin harvesting them? Several members of the board were quite strong about that point. And in fact, one of their biggest concerns was that the state law that designates this hunt indicates the season has to begin on the first Saturday in November. And they were wondering that if delisting happened in December, for example, if they'd be able to immediately begin hunting them literally days after delisting, I think if they had their way. That's really different than what happened with bald eagles. Bald eagles are another species, actually, that have recovered greatly in Wisconsin and other parts of the country and were taken off the endangered species list. But they were moved on to or were covered by the Bald Eagle and Golden Eagle Protection Act. So there was sort of a transitionary step that took place there that continued to provide protection really because of their great cultural significance that bald eagles hold. And I think there's a number of people who have been really proposing this idea that we need, especially for maybe large predators, some kind of unique status developed so that their value ecologically can be appreciated and protected even when delisting occurs.
It can't be just like an on-off red light, green light for hunting. You're looking for more of a yellow light, it seems.
Exactly.
Let's take a call now. Rich joining us from Rhinelander this morning. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks. I tuned in late, so perhaps you've covered this. I noticed when Mr. David was talking about the 360 figure of taken wolves, he said 360 known deaths of wolves. One doesn't have to go very far conversationally in northern Wisconsin to find people who will tell privately that a wolf was bothersome and that therefore they'll jokingly say there was a wolf, now there's no wolf. And I think we're in this realm of nice, noble species, which people immediately grant the eagles. But when they look at wolves that are an on-the-ground species, they sort of characterize them as inherently evil or dangerous.
Peter, your response there.
Well, there's no doubt that there's illegal activity going on, even now, while wolves are under the Endangered Species Act. And in fact, the DNR's most recent report discussed that, you know, amongst radio collared wolves that they had, in the last period, they had 14 wolves where the cause of death could be determined, and about two-thirds of those were actually illegally killed. So that is certainly taking place. And a lot of it goes back, again, I think, to these old myths about all the negative connotations that we put on wolves, most of which really don't hold up under scientific scrutiny. I'll just add, it's always been a little bit curious to me, you know, in aquatic systems in Wisconsin, probably the closest comparison you have to a wolf is a muskie. And you know, that's a top predator that has become sort of a revered thing in the fisheries world. And yet many people continue to have these very negative perspectives of wolves and sort of refuse to embrace, I think.
Who are also, that are also a top predator.
Exactly, exactly.
We're talking with Peter David, a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, discussing how U.S. wildlife officials aim to remove wolf protections by the end of the year and what this could mean for Wisconsin's population. Have you encountered a gray wolf while hunting or camping, one on your property in your own backyard? What did you do? What did you notice about it? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter, let me ask you this. What are there, if there are any relationships between wolves and the control of chronic wasting disease?
Well, it's a really good question. And I think there's a great need to do some deeper research into this issue. But there's some strong reasons to think that wolves may, in fact, be able to help us control the spread of chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin. The overlap of healthy wolf populations and chronic wasting disease on the landscape is limited, and there's been a number of modeling exercises that have been done that suggest that wolves could be really helpful that way. And it makes a lot of sense because wolves are, first of all, they will select, not entirely, but predominantly weakened and sick individuals, elderly, you know, the easiest prey on the landscape. And so they are out there targeting the kinds of animals that might be ill, and they're doing it 365 days a year. And so there's, you know, there's really, you can imagine it would be a challenging research from a scientific perspective.
Sure, sure.
But there's some very strong reasons to think that they could be very effective this way and to sort of take away this tool before we even really know how effective it is by reducing wolf populations. Seems like a very poor way to go. And we know, you know, there's a lot oftentimes made about the relationship between wolves and deer in general. But those are two species that co-evolved together for, you know, tens of thousands of years. And wolves do not eliminate deer. They really, in the long term, I think, are could be thought of as the pruners in the society, and they really create long-term health in the wolf population.
Let's bring in Steve now in Birchwood. Hi, Steve.
Oh, good morning. I just want to say I think you're really missing an opportunity here to help save your wolves. If there is a hunting season opened up and it's regulated by the state, not by the federal government, then the DNR issues tags, which you have to pay to join a lottery to hopefully receive a tag. Now, if there is such a huge want to save the wolf and not have a hunting season, then I suggest that you open hunting season up and all the folks that don't want a wolf harvested buy a tag. There you help fund the DNR, that helps fund your side of it. And if they do receive a tag and they do not wish to fill it, then you're also saving the population. So both sides win. The DNR wins by receiving more cash. You folks win by not harvesting a wolf if you happen to draw a tag in the lottery.
Okay, so Steve, kind of working the system there, a financial proposition there to support wolves through, financing DNR operations. Peter?
Well, Steve, that's an interesting idea. In the very short term, it might function that way to a degree. What would eventually happen is that if not many wolves are harvested, because most of the tags are purchased by non-hunters, for example, or wolf enthusiasts, the state will simply sell a larger number of permits until the quotas that they're interested in having harvested are reached.
What has the pandemic done to wolf populations, if anything at all?
Not that I'm aware of.
In terms of slowing down the legislation or the delisting, the federal efforts for regulation?
I'm not privy, I guess, to what's going on inside Fish and Wildlife Service. There are many people who think that a action on that proposed rule could happen very soon, very likely by the end of the year, if not sooner. So, but I imagine the pandemic has slowed down everything to a degree in the federal government.
Let's bring in Mark, who is joining us from Iowa County. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you. I thought we could go in just a little bit of a different direction. I remember reading I'm a high school science teacher, reading about the when wolves were returned to Yellowstone National Park, how the population, the wolves, transformed the landscape by their presence, and even if, especially with overrun numbers of elk. And I was curious, I like to try to keep my teaching local. Is there some similar, obviously a smaller study that would describe their the presence of the wolf population in Wisconsin on, say, Wisconsin forests or
the habitat in
sure,
an ecosystem?
The habitat,
yeah. Peter?
Sure. Yeah. Well, a quick comment on Yellowstone. It's such a great story in part because it reminds us about that intuitive reactions aren't always the correct reaction. And in Yellowstone, one thing you can look at there is with beavers. And wolves will also eat beaver. They're kind of the second most important prey. And so you would think that perhaps introducing wolves to the landscape would be a bad thing for beaver. In fact, beaver populations increased in Yellowstone. And it was really because it limited this overbrowsing that was taking place by elk in the river valleys, and it let some of that habitat grow up and become suitable for beavers. And so, you know, that's just a great reminder that things are oftentimes more complex than they might look on the surface. You know, in Wisconsin, the studies probably aren't quite as flashy, but there is a growing body of work that looks especially at things like forest health. And we know that certain tree species, cedars and hemlocks, for example, and some ground plants that are favored by deer, really are crowded out or browsed out of existence in cases when the deer population is too high. And while wolves really don't regulate the total number of deer on the landscape, they can create, I think, perhaps in the center of a PAX range, for example, an area where deer aren't left to sort of browse very.
And we have to pause there with Peter David on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with wildlife biologist Peter David. He's with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we're looking this hour at the future of gray wolves, what happens when endangered species protections for gray wolves are lifted. Let's bring in Cass now, joining us from Menasha. Hi, Cass.
Good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
I was going to my hunting stand early morning, and I encountered a pair of wolves north of Clintonville. And they crossed the road in front of me about 10 yards or 15 yards away, and they were not spooked. They were not afraid of anything. They just, just
went on their merry way.
Yeah. So that was interesting because they don't show any fear of anything. Like, obviously, I was not walking. I was driving, but they did not seem to care. So I was wondering about their range right now in the state of Wisconsin. We know that they are farther north than that, but now this is Clintonville, and this is a little bit farther south.
Peter, what is their range, and what do they make of humans?
Well, their range, you know, the vast majority of wolves in Wisconsin are found in the far northern third of the state, and then down into the central, what we call the central sands portion of Wisconsin. It would be unusual, certainly, to have wolves in Clintonville. And I will say, it's oftentimes surprisingly difficult to differentiate between wolves and coyotes in the field situations when you don't have a good reference. I'm not saying that was the case here, because it's also possible to see a wolf anywhere in the state. Wolves do disperse into new habitats at times, and they will make really remarkably large journeys. It's one of the things we're learning with GPS collars on wolves. You know, the sort of massive treks they can make at certain times. And so would it be possible to see a wolf anywhere in the state? But it's really the sort of the northern tier, sort of Highway 64 north, where the vast majority of the population is, and in that central sands. In terms of humans, you know, wolves tend, they're smart animals, and they may have some curiosity. But I think the vast majority of people who have interactions with wolves are lucky to have more than a fleeting glimpse of them. And in most instances, wolves would just as soon avoid people. You know, it's sort of an interesting thing. There's this common name for wolves in this area, sometimes called timber wolves. That's really referring to the same animal here as the gray wolves. I think that's an unfortunate name, because it sort of suggests that this is the habitat that wolves occupied. But historically, wolves were found in forested habitats, in the mountains, in the deserts. You know, they're very much habitat generalists.
How do you go about hunting them? What is the approach?
There is different ways that they can be hunted. It's actually something I prefer not talking about very much, because from the tribal perspective, that's a very, you know, it's really a difficult thing to hear about people recreationally harvesting your brother.
You right, know? Right. Yeah, so, understand. Access. Peter, when people talk about farm animals and livestock being killed by wolves and pet encounters with wolves, how prevalent is this?
Well, let's talk about livestock primarily first, because wolves will certainly occasionally kill livestock. It is, however, not a rampant problem. And in Wisconsin, only about 10 to 15% of all wolf packs have been associated with livestock depredation activities. And in sort of a typical year, there are about 35 farms that have confirmed depredations taking place on them. When a livestock raiser has a suspected loss, they're instructed to try to protect that evidence and call federal agents who get on the site as quickly as possible and try to determine, was this loss actually caused by wolves or by bears, by coyotes, or was an animal perhaps stillborn and then scavenged upon, those kinds of things. For verified wolf losses, there is a depredation program in place. And it's not perfect. You know, you're never going to be able to verify every wolf loss that takes place. But I think it's pretty good. And the level of mortality, the overall, is not that great. The number of cattle that are killed or maimed by wolves in a typical year is sort of on the order of the number that go to slaughter in Wisconsin every 30 minutes, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So from an industry level, it's not a huge issue. But if you are one of those individuals who have had losses, certainly it's an issue to you. When you talk about pets, and especially dogs, the vast majority of losses in the state are hunting dogs, and especially hounds, bear hunting hounds in particular. Wisconsin is one of the few places that allows the hunting of bears with dogs, and they also have a very long training season that puts bear hounds in the woods at the time that wolves are having their young, they're at rendezvous sites. And they are territorial and protective of that, and have, you know, and will kill dogs. There are some steps that could be taken to add greater protection to those dogs, such as shortening that training season. The losses of pets does sometimes happen. Those things are quite rare, typically in the single digits in any given year in the entire state. Oftentimes low single digits, but again, it does sometimes happen. And like just about any wildlife species, you know, there's positives and negatives. You know, there are losses from coyotes and fishers and negative interactions with deer. All of those things go on. So if we're going to live, coexist with these species on the landscape, then there are going to be some people who are going to have some losses.
We're talking with Peter David, who is a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, as we look at the future for gray wolves and the protections for the population here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Let's bring in Diane now, joining us from Mercer. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So about the plant thing, I learned that all those plants under the trees also are important for nutrition of the deer. And if too many deer, all you have is Pennsylvania sedge and ferns left, which is what we have here in Mercer. But, okay, about 15 years ago, I was running with two dogs on SS, and my mailbox is on SS, and came over this hill, and there were five wolves by the mailbox, and I wanted to get home. So I yelled, "Get out of here," and they scattered, and we ran past the mailbox and down our road home, and the dogs never reacted, so I assumed the wolves had been in that area for a while, and they had smelled them before. So that must have been a good pack leader that knew how to coexist with people in an area.
Diane, we're short on time. Peter, what do you make of that encounter?
Well, I just thank you for sharing it. I think it shows these are complex animals, but much of what we're taught about them is not always true. And encourage people to try to have the opportunity to at least listen and appreciate some of the positive benefits of Myingan on the landscape.
As we look to close here, what do you hope ultimately happens to gray wolves, their population here in Wisconsin?
Well, our member tribes, and myself personally, I would say, you know, we'd just like to see this population to be ecologically functional on the biggest part of the landscape that it can, that it's, we should let wolves decide what's the most suitable places for them to live, especially on sort of a large landscape level. And so if we can let that population remain healthy, remain ecologically functional, let this restoration take place the way it has, preserve what we've captured, I think we've come a great way.
We've come a great way, but you still see population growth as a goal.
I don't think growth necessarily, but not a loss of what we've attained to this point in time.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter David is a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, as we've been spending the hour on what the future of gray wolves look like here in Wisconsin. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.